find together.
Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
7 o'clock, you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. You know what that means. It's time for Here and Now with Rachel C. I am your host, Rachel C. Joining me in the studio tonight is the one and only Albert Kirchner. We are going to kick things off with a little something from former guest Even Twice. This is a new one they just dropped called Never to Be Seen Again. Thank you for tuning in to Radio Free Brooklyn on this lovely November evening. I am Rachel C. This is Here and Now, where we celebrate live performance, culture, and activism in the arts. And on that note, I have show listings, activity listings for you to do because, hey, I want you to go out and do the thing. I'll tell you about what's going on tonight, Thursday night at Berlin, 25 Avenue A, 8 p.m. to 11 p.m. So you can still listen to Here and Now and still make the show. Johnny Couch, Velveteen Rabbit, and Jane Church will be performing. Two things coming up that are RFB related. RFB is we have RFB Presents, and basically we're putting on some live shows at local community venues on a regular basis. We have a monthly thing on Mondays at the Footlight. This Monday coming up, it goes from 7 to 9 p.m. That's at the Footlight again, 465 Seneca Avenue in Ridgewood. Radio Free Brooklyn presents Fish Out of Agua, a story show. Former Here Now guest and current Radio Free Brooklyn host, Michelle Carlo, is in charge of this one. Fish Out of Agua is her novel. She is a renowned storyteller and performer. You're going to want to check this out because she's doing it. She's booked. It's a storytelling show, but there will be fun and games as well with prizes. If you've ever been to one of Michelle's show, there's some participation, but it's fun and it's easy. And you walk out with stuff. And the show is named for her novel, Fish Out of Agua. You should go check that out. It's a really great book. Also, starting next month, we'll have the first RFB Presents, first Thursdays at the Well. The Well, of course, over at 272 Messerell Street in Brooklyn. Show starts at 8. We'll be doing this the first Thursday of every month, presenting live shows with featuring local acts. In December, it'll be Jackknife, Stiletto, Nuclear Family, and Fantasy and Red Arcade. And that's also going to be our holiday party. So stop on by at the Well. Jeez, I never really, I had my background music planned for tonight. I had no idea it was this jaunty. it's the headphones in the studio are way better than what I had at home when I produced this. If you ever had any questions as to whether or not this is a live show, like just moments like that, just weird, like, hey, she surprised herself with her music there. Also, a way to, if you want to, you know, help support RFB, there is, of course, our donate button on the screen before you right now. We are like a 501c3, an official nonprofit. There is some merch left over from the tag sale. You can reach out to Radio Free Brooklyn, contact us, and see when you might be able to schedule an appointment to take a look at some things, including some videography equipment, audio equipment. Also, if are you an Amazon shopper? You can help RFB this holiday season and year-round now by utilizing Amazon Smile. Prime members are able to, you basically, Amazon Smile is what you sign up for this and you choose a charity and a percentage of your purchases go to that charity. It's really easy. It's stupidly easy. Just like buy whatever you normally do on Amazon or pay your Prime thing or whatever and we get some money. So check that out, please. Radio Free Brooklyn on Amazon Smile. Okay. And there's another monthly show going on right now, just across the ways at the Bushwick Public House comedy show. And my guest is the guy behind that, or one of the three people behind it. Hello, Albert. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Just a quick correction. It is a weekly thing.
It's
all right.
Weekly thing. It is a weekly thing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about the format or the kind of acts you guys have booked?
Yeah. So the three of us have been here for about 2 years, moved here separately, and we're booking a lot of people that are kind of exciting to us and are kind of unknown on the bigger stand-up platform. New York is full of so many people who are just absolute devastators. It's great. There's some really good comedy here, and it's just kind of a long line of people trying to become famous. And if you get them before, it's just like a cool little treat. So I think this is a good, this is a good way to peek into who's going to be doing some incredible things in the future.
Are you kind of creating an environment in which you can kind of people can try things out a little bit to maybe comedy, but not your standard setup delivery punchline kind of thing? Or is it
this time? It's I've done a lot of all of the shows I've ever produced have been a lot of no rules, go nuts. Let's just get weird with it.
Yeah.
And this one is more strictly stand up, but it is I kind of encourage material that's you're afraid to do. Uh-huh. It's a good place to try stuff that's a little more, I don't want to say dangerous because it is just jokes, but just kind of a more tougher material and topics to cover. And I'm really excited by people trying to go for it.
Yeah, well, I mean, there is a difference between pushing creative boundaries and not having a safe space. That's a lot of talk about this in comedy and society in general recently with a lot of, of course, the recent news. I think that, and I had a friend who's a comic recently said, what is safe comedy? It was an interesting discussion that can come out of that. What do you mean by safe? I mean, we should all, it's always been designed to push some boundaries and get you thinking.
Sure. I mean, I started in an environment that was kind of the last dying vestiges of 80s comedy in mm-hmm. Seattle. And so nothing about that was safe for really anyone.
Yeah.
And the jokes weren't at the time, they weren't really that impressive. So there was no reason for this weird hostile environment.
Yeah.
And so for me, my initial relationship with safe spaces was just friendly to women. That's it. Just very broadly. And you could tell that the city had noticed that comedy was not friendly to women because the first time that was printed, every show was sold out.
Right.
Just kind of
I know a lot of women comics and I know women who, just stepped away from it years ago because they just went the difference there is that hostile was the thing, and it's comedy, people are going to joke at each other and at each other's expense, but it sort of took this turn where it was it was for a lot of women I think felt like it was just kind of ugly and they just I couldn't, I'm not an alpha kind of aggressor.
yeah but luckily I mean there's still some thriving, but leather jacket comedy is dying, and I'm really happy about it.
That's great. Yeah, I just think of all the stories, and I have people who produce shows, and it was kind of like how that, they, the I knew of someone who was, you know, women who produced some comedy shows at a series theaters many years ago, and women said it was great. You know, we went to you, and you know, said that they were part of a comedy, like some kind of act, and it happened to be the two women in the act that were there and kind of auditioned. He said, "You guys are great." Well, we have these other guys in our group. He said, "Can I check them out that though before I book you?" And they were like, "You want to see the men? You don't care?" And he's, he didn't think anything of it. He told me later, he said, "Well, yeah, I saw them and I knew they were funny. I just want to make sure these guys were funny too and these women." I said, "But no, that was just so out of the norm back in like the early 90s.
Even some now, I mean, some friends of mine went on tour and they did a show where the producer didn't know all three of them, but was like really opposed to the one woman not headlining. Like, you don't know, you, these other two guys could be terrible. One of them was brand new."
Yeah, like, you know, it's so just bonkers. Like, let's look at like, you know, well, you actually, you know, are you funny? You know, and one thing, and I applaud you for kind of you know, producing a show that's kind of diverse in its content and being out there but still quality.
Yeah, I mean, we don't, I wouldn't say we advertise ourselves as a safe space, but we want to treat performers, you know, they're our friends.
Yeah.
I'm not gonna, I don't want people to come back.
Yeah.
And also, if it feels like a fun, cool place to be, people come back
exactly
over and over again.
All right. So, and this is happening. So, this is every Monday over at Bushwick Public House.
Every Tuesday.
Every Tuesday.
Yeah,
that's
8.
The second time tonight. I'm sorry.
I'm keeping track. Don't worry.
You keep track. Do we still have the bell on the desk? We can ding every time something. There was a bell on the desk once. Who knows what happened to that? You're listening to Here Now with Rachel C on Radio Free Brooklyn. If you miss any of tonight's broadcast or you just want to catch the whole thing over, tune in. My rebroadcast now is Sundays at noon. Yes, it's a new season at Radio Free Brooklyn. So Sundays at noon, and it'll be up next week on Mixcloud. So what's interesting to me about also what you're describing and then the location where you're doing this, this is very reminiscent of the kind of scene that I came out of in terms, you know, years ago, and what inspired me to do this show was, you know, these theaters that we had downtown. I was part of the Lower East Side, East Village sort of scene. And it was very, you know, open, like try different things, try push boundaries. What is storytelling? What is comedy? But even physically, the space, you're in the lower level of a space. It's very reminiscent of Cake Shop. Listeners who are familiar with rock clubs in New York City, it's a kind of a cake shed.
Had one of the biggest shows there for ages, comedy shows.
Yeah. Yeah, so I think it's a very cool thing. You're kind of capturing what people come to New York for, and sometimes it's harder to find now. But what's if you want to tell people the address and details, the time, the mic and everything.
I still looked at the address of the Bushwick Public House, it's on Myrtle, and
it's right where Myrtle DeKalb. Central and DeKalb all meet in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Coffee shop during the day, rock club at night. They have a really awesome downstairs venue, and we do it there every week. So if you're just hanging out, you're not going to get bombarded by comedy, but it's going to be there. Okay. And I mean, every week so far that we've done it, people from the bar have come down and they've stayed. They seem to have really enjoyed it.
What made you want to start this?
Honestly, selfish reasons. It's like a gym for us. Every Tuesday I get to do 5 to 10 minutes, and I mean, and it's like in my environment, so there's no other people's pressure in my head. There's just working out and kind of
build your own. It's like your own home gym, except it's at Bushwick Public House.
Yeah. Like, I've also found that if you like find a way to feed yourself a little, you get a little less like curmudgeon-y about what else is going on in your comedic life.
Interesting. That maybe that's advice we could all take and apply it not just to comedic lives, but in other
The guy who introduced me to this radio station, Jeff Mackin, did comedy here for like 20 years. And it was a lot of that, a lot of very experimental, a lot of people who now do not strictly comedy, but all sorts of different performative things for a living.
Yeah.
And that's what he kind of got into my head immediately, was I wasn't getting the stage time I wanted. And so he's like, let's just make it.
Yeah, and make your own thing.
Yeah,
there you go. And you said we. So you're not doing this alone.
No, I'm doing this with Evan Morrison, who's also from Seattle. We started comedy together, I mean, almost 6 years ago now, I guess. And then Maria Wojciechowski from Chicago, who's amazing. She has this Instagram right now called I Look Like Laura Dern. And it's all these pictures where she poses like the pictures she took from Laura Dern. And it's huge, but it's really fun.
That's like, I love the conceptual Instagrams. It's like, the parody Twitter accounts from years back. It's like kind of, but it's good.
You see people find a good one, it's really entertaining.
It's like, what was the dad that like was kind of
coffee
mean?
Dad?
There was kind of mean. He was trying to imitate his daughter's like what he thought were silly Instagram things, and or there was one person who mimicked one of the Kardashians and just how ridiculous it is. Like if you actually pose that way and dress that way, like in no way, shape, like it's just, it looks like we're.
It's so bizarre. I mean, I guess like this pursuit isn't that far from a similar lifestyle, but I've just, there's no part of me that feels like that's something I should do.
It's my, I guess if you're trying to break down like, or address like weird standards of beauty and norms like that and kind of say, hey, this is what a regular person looks like in that pose. Or
so
in
fun.
This scenario or outfit, like look how, I mean, if it's, if you want to like really kind of paste together an image, call it what it is, then call it like art, like an artistic photograph. We know this person doesn't look like that, but if you're going to present yourself as if you look like this all the time, like some celebrities do, or, you know, but it's,
well, it's
I like the breaking down of the myth of what this, you know, is what people look like.
Tina Fey had a really decent article about just kind of like that line of how much you should Photoshop or what you should tweak for pictures to that, because that means there's a lot of process after the picture that kind of,
yeah, like how much
the models that don't look like them at all.
Yeah.
And there's a almost like violent level for a lot of models where like they just cut parts of your body off in my picture and just a completely fake thing. But maybe sometimes like, you know, if you're going to be a visual person for a living, it's okay to touch up a little, but it's wild how much we like just shape people's bodies.
I know drag queens with Instagrams. Yes, you're going to be look really done up because you're, and that's your profession. But you say like, you're not saying I rolled out of bed. You're saying, and then I'm kind of putting together a costume.
And it seems like there's a difference between maybe an empowering way to do it versus, oh, your body's just not going to be good enough.
Right.
And we have to hide that fact.
Exactly. So, again, so you are from Pennsylvania. You went out to Seattle. You told me straight from high school. And I know you just kind of decided a few years ago, I'm going to go to New York now.
Yeah. Well, once I started comedy, everything kind of just became about that. So New York, that was the big move. It was like, mm-hmm. I'll be here. There's a lot of people who try really hard, and I'll get better by being surrounded by them.
So you're just like, I'm ready to really go into comedy full time. I mean, a lot of artists have other work that they do because you all got to eat. It just like, this is, I'm ready to like commit on that level, or
kind of, yeah, I want to make this my thing. And I have a very similar story in a lot of other people where I was kind of floundering in life. And so this wasn't, I want to say calling, but really it was just something I found that I was excited to actually work hard at. And so that, then it just absorbed me entirely.
If you really are excited to do something, you're going to get better at it. Even if you truly suck at it, I think at some point you're going to improve in it. Some people just like, you should. Most people, I think, enjoy doing things they're good at naturally, you know. I think that's an important lesson, important thing to remember is that, you know, hopefully if you love something enough, you'll really.
And with like a lot of stuff, I mean, I'm not very good at being like a tactician about how I go practice. I'm kind of just smash my face into the wall until I'm better.
Uh-huh.
And this is the best city to do that in.
Want to be extreme? Come to New York.
Yeah.
And your comedic style, like it seems like lame words for it, but what your performances are like are not like your. I mean, I've read reviews of your stuff that go as far as to call it psychedelic. I guess in that it's envelope pushing and it's a lot of improv. It's a lot of,
I mean, that's kind of like where my edginess is. I don't really go to rile up the crowds. I kind of go to rile up the bookers.
The crowds can just sit back and enjoy bookers.
I mean, when it goes really well, like I'm really happy with what I do, but the learning curve was whenever I would be bad at it, it would be very, very bad. So like the people who were putting on shows got a little wary of the how unreliable it was.
Uh-huh.
But like, you know, you do something for 6 years, you kind of figure some of it out.
Yeah, you must be onto something if you've been doing it that many years and you keep booking. So do Kurt, like a lot of comics, I'm sure it's a lot of comedy, social commentary. Are there any issues in the news or in social issues right now, they're kind of making their way into your. You're telling me a little bit about something you're working on. If you want to share that,
I'm more of like a foreign policy guy, I guess I'd say. like, I want my comedy to represent empathy and sympathy for like large causes here now, you know, like women's rights and just, you know, just kind of, I don't ever want to be like, I have trouble, like, I don't want to be speaking for other people. I kind of want to represent also being on their side, if that makes sense, in comedy. So I tend to focus a lot on, like, why we bomb brown teens for money. That's kind of, like, my big number one issue. I mean, Uzbekistan, like, doesn't directly get the brunt of that, but that's such an interesting thing where the borders of that country are different than the cultural borders of the people that live in that area.
Right.
And so you do have a lot of like just odd overlap and like, okay, well, this country we'll be friends with and we have an airstrip here and so we can kill the people 10 feet away.
I know, it's weird. We create and it's, or break down boundaries like as they.
And that's, I mean, that's Russia trying to own that part of the world and then failing. And now there's so much poverty and it's just, these lines are kind of divided by white people, and it's very, it's just an odd relationship with that country, and that's kind of what has been freaking me out recently.
It's easy. Your appearance color is something you see, so it becomes an easy thing to zone in on, that first layer of like, how are you different? You look different from me physically, so I can somehow like identify, put you over there, like you're somehow other. And if you look at, you know, there are parts of the world where countries where people or appear a little more homogeneous, like, and it's along class lines, you know, if you go to like some of the islands, like in the Caribbean, like everyone might appear to be like, there's less of a difference in physical class. Like everyone's got somewhere a closer range of melanin, you know, and, but like, you know, if you eliminate the race issue that people, there's a social class difference, you know, and you see that in European countries as well. It's like we somehow want to segregate.
Well, rich white people are also super obsessed with eugenics. So then, like, especially in, like, this country and in parts of Europe, it seems like that class system is also visually represented in people. I've just listened to this whole, like, three-hour thing about the Trump's family and just how they've been treating the world around them, like, starting with his father and them. And that's just most of it.
You know, and, no shortage of Trump bashing on this show. Just my show. I do not speak for RP on this.
That was the saucy joke I've been running for a bit.
But no, it's like everybody in New York always hated him. And they knew about his dad and all the discrimination suits. And we're just like, really? He's getting, oh, Jesus.
Yeah, that family has left a scar in their wake in this country for decades before even getting near the presidency.
Yeah, exactly. You actually have a piece on the draft that you were telling me about.
When I was 18,
launch into this a little bit.
My English teacher got all the other 18-year-old guys together and kind of gave us this big spiel about, you have to sign this paper. This is for the government. If you don't sign it, you won't be able to get loans for college. Life is going to be very hard. It's going to be annoying. Just sign it. And that was the only conversation we've ever had about the draft. That's how I joined. And I was just like, that's always been so horrifying to me. And everyone has this relationship with it. Like, it's not really going to come back. It's fine. It's this ethereal thing that doesn't exist, even though we still have these very chaotic and violent men in power. And I have no faith that it'll never come back, but I kind of want it to now. I'd love that. I'd love if Trump screwed up so bad they needed the draft and then the military had to deal with this generation of curvy, gentle boys. I'd love that. I mean, we're incredible soldiers. I know all of the vocab to your guns and I have none of the heart to use them.
Do you want to do that piece you were working on?
I mean, that was
that,
it.
That was it, the whole thing. That is funny though. So what are some other pieces you have on this is the stage?
Well, a lot of the stuff
I perform.
Well, a lot of the stuff I've been talking about lately is this weird discrepancy of like, I come from a part of the world this country seems to hate, but I've been treated so well by this country. Like my wife, I love my family and I love America despite its many failings. I absolutely love this country. It's by far one of the most fun places in the world. It's crazy. And like maniacs can do a lot here, which is both great and terrible. But also it's very odd. Like I just felt like I just fell on the right side of brown versus white and really dodged a drone strike on that one. Here. It's so just bonkers to me how different my life would have been if one white lady didn't bring me here.
Right. And you were telling me earlier, just for those of you who don't know, you were adopted. You were born in Uzbekistan.
Correct. Yeah.
And you were adopted by a white family in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. This is odd because, white family, Pennsylvania, very small town. Uh-huh. Boom. One Uzbek. All right. Now, my brother, white guy, gets very into international studies, marries an Uzbek woman, two Uzbeks. She has a 16-year-old son, three Uzbeks. What's up, Segertown, Pennsylvania? We're your black people now.
Ah, you're just like, it's just multiplied. You let one in and they just take over. Three.
We're brown and hairy and we love lamb.
Irish family growing up, my Irish Scottish English family growing up, my aunts and uncles used to joke with us cousins growing up, can someone marry someone from a background with a more exciting cuisine, because it was starting to get boring. And my cousin married someone who was French Canadian and Polish, born here but like grandparents were from, and he brought kielbasa to a family picnic once, and it was the most exciting thing. And I'm like, I'm looking at my parents like, we're the ones who who still lived in Brooklyn. I'm like, we can go to Greenpoint and get this.
Yeah, like, there's pierogies everywhere.
And then from that point forward, it was like we always tried to go into more. my dad was the youngest, and all the siblings moved out to the middle of nowhere, New Jersey. And we stayed in Brooklyn, but because we lived furthest away, when we did these big potluck kind of family gatherings, we brought this like the drinks because we were from so far away. We weren't expected to like cook something and bring it with. And so that it was like, we could and when I try to go, when I see my family in Jersey, I try to like, get the good bagels and the real Italian, I go to Little Italy for like the Italian delis and groceries for the good mozzarella cheese and all that other kind of stuff. I bring it for them. But it was one of those like, they were like, somebody marry someone more interesting because the food sucks it.
That's a big leap from Irish to Polish.
Well, it was also, it's just, when we're, Ireland, you boil everything. You boiled it. I've been to Ireland. They're better cooks than that. They actually have like the best quality food. They just don't know how to season it. Well, everything's really local and fresh. So if it doesn't grow there, they don't have it. And, their meat is like the best. It's organic, it's there, but they don't know how to, it's like the blandest stuff. And came here, my dad, we were like fixed dinner and we cooked, but my dad had, a basil plant out in the yard and the fresh, and they were just like falling over basil because it's not like, it doesn't grow where they are, even though they, through the EU.
I wonder if that's what Italy, but that's what fueled the viciousness of the British Empire. Just like, oh my gosh, these people know how to season food. We got to spread.
Yeah, we need curry. It's just a lot of British cooking is based on a dare. I can say that because I'm British. Like, isn't it interesting? I say I can say that because, but like, come on, do you think is that kind of a rule in comedy?
I like everyone in America gets to say that. We just have that one.
Is that a rule? Like I can make fun of my own ethnic group to which I belong, but not others? Or
I think England has gotten real lucky. I think they've gotten as far as like getting to gently secede from owning the world while we take all of their like crazy flack. Like we'll start wars so that everyone forgets that you used to be the last empire like a year ago.
It's hilarious. On that note, we're going to take a little bit of a music break because we're about the halfway point here. I'm going to drop something from next week's guests. Next week, yes, you can tune in on Thanksgiving at 7 p.m. My guest will be the one and only Revolution. Here's a little something from them called Weird Little Minds.
I got it. What is next? There's something.
we're back. You're listening to Here Now with Rachel C. on Radio Free Brooklyn. Albert Kirshner is my guest. Once again, Albert's got, along with Evan and Maria, a weekly show at Bushwick Public House Comedy. If you want to see things that are maybe a little outside of the box, go check out that show. I want to talk to you, Albert, about your background is very interesting. I know you're from technically from Uzbekistan. You were adopted by a white family in Pennsylvania, and yeah. You told me before
God
the
bless
show,
Lucy Kirshner.
You told me that your mom seems like a very, like, you know, she just, it's just not that she feels for the suffering of others. She'll go show up and do something about it, or she'll really...
Well, it's like her family went through the Depression. It's so like everyone, her generation and before in our family, could build you your house. That was like a big, everyone's kind of a carpenter. Uh-huh. Everyone can do that kind of work. So she's really, if she sets her mind on something, it's going to get done.
Yeah.
Or it'll take an army of bureaucrats to stop
her. Right.
Like, for example, we're a soccer family, and we grew up in a dumb football town. And anytime she wanted, like, she wanted my brothers to play soccer. So she would go to the school board and say, hey, I'll pay for the field. I'll pay for the equipment. Just, like, let them schedule it with the school. And people would fight her and fight her and fight her.
Really? Like, someone's going to pay for you to have an extracurricular athletic activity, like, that could make your town.
It's almost like the smaller and less chance you have of ever graduating a professional athlete, the more protective you are of your football program. It's so bizarre. The only thing that's ever come out of Segertown football is a paralyzed guy. It's so upsetting.
I used to think about, people are really emotional. People are emotional about their sports, but football especially. And I had this whole, like, I'm not watching the NFL this season. I just, you know, I for a couple of years now have been like, you know, is it right for me to, like, support this, or even by turning it on the TV, or because this issue of the head injuries, and now it's really come out as how severe the CTE is and stuff, and it's kind of like the emotional attachment to football is a little interesting compared to, like, you know, if basketball players were, like, getting those kind of injuries, I think most NBA fans would be like, you know what? You need to change something.
Well, like, I think the NBA is getting a boost because of just how much crap is around the NFL right now.
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's what's so scary is how tied it is to our military. Of how, if you go to a game, you better be rooting for us to kill some people overseas.
Yeah,
that's why we're here.
It's worth. Although, you know, what's come out is what's resurfaced is information that was out there a couple of years ago, is that the DOD was purchasing or you know, kind of like advertising space by.
Oh yeah.
That's essentially what it boiled down to, by saying, "Hey, we'd like you to require everyone to stand for the anthem and blah blah blah." But they were paying. Like, there were contributions. It was a cash thing, and I believe the NFL is also a 501c3. So there's a whole. It was a cash thing, but it was basically that we need to boost enrollment in the military. A lot of people watch football. Okay. And they work this thing out. So this whole, like, you know, it's not about honoring the veterans. This was the DOD was basically advertising.
And it's like, I mean, you would have more soldiers if we're fighting wars that weren't so shady.
Yeah. Like,
that's, you're having trouble getting people to go fight random teens for you. Yeah, that's odd.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't actually have a problem with the violence of the NFL. I think if we're going to be a country that survives off of vicious violence with wars, then our entertainment should at least mirror parts of that. So we're not like delusional thinking that we're just these gentle bears rolling around.
Gentle people.
But it is upsetting how much of aggressive recruitment and just flag loving it is.
Yeah, and it's like with Kaepernick, like we should be free to disagree, and you know, it's just
And it's upsetting to me to think that you love your country because you're blindly loyal to something. That's not love. That's codependence.
Yeah, codependence.
Love is knowing why you should hate something too.
Love is like if I love you, I'll tell you when you screwed up.
Yeah.
Or when you need to rein it in.
The black community in this country has a more deeply personal relationship with this country, I think, than anyone growing corn in the woods. You know,
I don't know if part of this has to do with, I think a lot of it has to be myself being a New Yorker raised by politically active parents in a city like New York City. But also, we're not that long in this country. So that whole sense of I'm American and proud, I didn't really have it growing up. It was a little like, yeah, I get why I appreciate living here as opposed to someplace else, and I like my Bill of Rights, I do and stuff, but yeah, it's kind of it's interesting, different perspectives in this country, like this whole, like, it's like, do I, you know, people like, I don't know, I didn't grow up with a sense of, my sense of patriotism was like, exercise your rights and your right to protest and speak out. That was how that you were patriotic, was by, not by saluting a flag, but by actually dissenting to like they're just a rebel or something.
I mean, you can love your neighbor and also be viciously mad at them for like arrogance that they have.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think one other thing about Colin Kaepernick, he does really walk the talk, because what the money he's put into different programs for people. Yeah, he's not just he's not just talking. The suit program, giving away suits to parolees, is a good example of that. Like, we're real hands-on, makes a difference directly in somebody's life. Like, I have a parole hearing, I'm looking for work, here's a suit. Here's something to wear to that. Like, you know, he's really, and that's, it's not just like funneling money into an organization that does and trickles down. It's like right there. He's just walking, you know.
Very direct.
It's very, it's direct.
And it's unfortunate that he doesn't get to work now because he does this stance. And I have friends who are reasonable people who still were upset at him for causing trouble for the team. And you're like, this isn't negative attention for football. This is negative attention for our country. We shouldn't be scared of it.
Yeah.
We should embrace it so we can heal these things.
Yeah, acknowledge what's going on so you can talk. That's beautiful. Like,
if you talk to anyone over 50 who's against this, ask them. Ask them how people should protest. They'll never have a real answer for you.
Yeah.
You're never, because like that act of protesting, if you really confront with what he's addressing, it's incredibly uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable and it's not the fun of football.
It's true peaceful protest.
It's so, he is so not, nonviolent. It's so incredible.
About as nonviolent or non-intrusive as you can get. It's the least, it's not disruptive at all.
And it's like, followed by 2 hours of violence.
Yes.
And for some reason, that kneeling is so upsetting to people. And I mean, when I drove, I was on the road, like, in the middle of this whole thing. So we were seeing news stations from all across the country. And you just keep hearing pundits and people saying, I miss the warrior generation. I miss when we were warriors. And it was just so, like, you just shut up and go fight whoever I want you
tell
to fight for me.
Tell that to an active duty Marine now. No, really. You know, like, you could tell, like, somebody who's over there in the thick of it right now, you're going to tell them they're not a warrior. They're their generation. But come on, man.
Yeah, and there's, like, incredible, there's so many incredible veterans protesting issues in this country. And it's It's not hating your country to know what's wrong with it.
Right. Exactly. No, it's like let's you know, it's like saying you have a big machine and it's like, I'm going to ignore that fact that machine's malfunctioning over there rather than addressing it. Like I smell gas in my home.
Yeah.
I could just open a window and put on a fan. I won't call Con Ed.
Like, but if someone else mentions it, they're against your house.
Yeah, exactly.
The integrity of your home.
The integrity of my home. Because, but
it's also comfort. I mean, this country is really about getting your family here and building an empire so you can just chill out and play and watch Netflix and play video games. And then if your family has, for generations, had a leg up on people and have gotten to do that, then anybody else afterwards are like, wait, there's still work to do. It's in the way. You know, I got stuff to do. I got Halo and stuff at home.
I've got Halo. you came here. Albert, you were raised in Pennsylvania. You move out to Seattle right after high school. Why Seattle?
Well, our family was kind of like the one liberal family for a while. And my older brothers were really into cool stuff. One of my older brothers, all of his friends were in bands and they all moved out to Seattle and they skateboarded. And it was just all stuff I thought was cool. And so when I was in high school, I was going to shows every weekend with my friends. Mm-hmm. And I needed to have like the next step of that when I was done with high school. Mm-hmm. I couldn't do what everyone else is doing. Mm-hmm. And so I just thought that would be the thing to do. I would go to Seattle, I'll go get into the music scene, I'll see what life is about. And I spent a year playing World of Warcraft and maybe went to one concert.
but found yourself in the comedy scene out there, which was...
Yeah, well, I tried school for a bit. That didn't work either. And after that, I was like really freaking out over what am I doing? And I just started trying dumb stuff that was fun. I wanted to start doing stuff for me rather than building a career or life.
Right.
And this really hit me. Something like I could obsess over and really work hard at and maybe build into something someday.
I mean, it is a craft. I mean, if you're doing it well, the craft work involved with comedy. When I talk with comics about like, no, this is what, you know, there's an eloquence I hear comics use in their speech when talking about the delivery and the importance of the beat and the everything.
Yeah. And now, like, a lot of stuff I focus on is more mindset. Before, I started realizing that all of those things, all the mechanics that are kind of underlying in an act, all kind of like become organic. And if you can get yourself to be in a kind of very good place, really healthy, open, and fun, then that stuff will be taken care of. And so that's more what I work on is like, do I have the right amount of energy? Am I like feeling clean? Did I work out a little today? It's just something
so important, like with live performance in general, whatever your medium is, whatever your art is. But I'm sure that threw a lot of producers who were trying to book you, right? Because you were like,
I still have like, I have chips on my shoulder from Seattle, but they weren't entirely wrong. And I, also it was Seattle, so it was like the pot movement. So I think I was maybe high on stage every day for the first 2 years.
Yeah, there's a pot movement here.
Everywhere. It's pretty great.
Everywhere there's a pot movement.
This country is both incredibly Christian and violent and chill and awesome.
Yeah, that's the and the antidote to all that violent Christendom is a lot of time. So, I know you've told me earlier, I've read in interviews, you decided just at one point a few years ago, I got to come to New York. And comedy had something to do with it, but you just one day just kind of went, I got to.
Well, my brother, he's an ER doctor, and he did his residency at Beth Israel.
Okay.
So I would visit when I was still in Pennsylvania with my friends, and just the sheer, I mean, going from Segertown, Pennsylvania, which has one stoplight, no cops, a bank, kind of. To straight from the first city I go into is New York, and then Manhattan. It was so exciting. I was always like, it was either that or Seattle. Chose Seattle, then found comedy, and now I have an excuse and a reason and like a direction if I move here.
Right.
And that was really exciting. And like, you want to be around people who are better than you. And so you can kind of like, that's how I learned. I started comedy. I saw a bunch of people do it and I got better because I saw cool ways they were doing it. Uh-huh. And now I'm just kind of upgrading the people I'm surrounded by.
Wow. So what, I mean, you knew people in the two places, cities you relocated to. That's always makes it, that's just smart. Going to some place where you actually know somebody. Maybe have some family and stuff. How does this kind of moving around, has that informed your art at all? Having, you know, lived in the places you've lived and when you've lived there also.
Well, Seattle is very like comedically liberal. It's a very like, I mean, a lot of safe space stuff. Like Seattle, Portland, it's a lot of like kind of more hardcore liberals running rooms. And I'm really glad I started there. I'm really glad that I started with like really empathetic comedy. Really glad I started by these people because like New York is really cool, but it has everyone, it has the whole spectrum of comedy. And just depending where you plop down, you can kind of pick one way and go the other. And what has really helped with starting somewhere else was kind of getting a little more secure in what I'm interested in and what kind of stuff I like to see.
Right. So I'll ask this question of you that I ask of everyone who comes on the show that I know has performed in, you know, different parts of the country or world. How does New York compare, performing in New York compared to performing in, say, Seattle or any other place that you've been?
In Seattle, open mics have people. I was, like, learning. I was doing open mics. We just throw your name on a list for 50-plus people, like humans who are coming to see a show. Here, our shows don't even, like, that level of show would be like a huge achievement in my year.
Right.
And you're performing for a lot of other comics, but it's kind of like the four best comics from each city move to LA or New York. Mm-hmm. And so you're like the open mics are for just comics, but their taste, if you take it with a little grain of salt, it's like training with weight training, you know, it's harder. And if you can get stuff to work in front of them and that people can actually relate to, that material will probably be a lot stronger than it would have been if you just did it for people the whole time.
Going back to the gym reference for your show.
Not that I have ever go to a gym.
Is you find that I've had a lot of guests on the show, comics, fans, storytellers, whatever their art is, note that New York is kind of saturated compared to some other parts of the country or the world. And that might play into like why, you know, Seattle that saturated, or is that you think that's part of why?
I watched the whole country blow up over the last 7 years with stand up. When I started, it was like less than 10 people showing up to stuff, and it was 50 when I left. And you could just see that nationally, and it's because there was more work, I think, comedically. There's more access to different styles. It wasn't just whatever radio station or comedy club you could go to, and then whoever happened to be there, you can connect directly to people you actually enjoy.
Right.
I think that's, so now there's this it's saturated everywhere.
Yeah. Although, that's part of why the rooms got big in Seattle. Like, hey, what we need something to do tonight. I could go do this thing. Or is it like, because it near, you know, you're kind of, other artists have told me, well, we're kind of competing for the attention of, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Everyone's competing.
The Boss has a musical on Broadway.
Yeah.
I have to pull people every Tuesday at 8. Billy Joel has a residency at Madison Square Garden. All
right. You mentioned work for comics. How's that changed? Like actual work in comedy, not just like you have a gig so that you can do stand up at night.
I mean, as far as from what I've seen, I'm not getting a lot of work. So this is coming purely from what I'm seeing, yeah. Speculation, but it seems that it's more, you're going to get paid less, but you're going to have a little more control over your project. And there's way more people that are gatekeepers to that kind of stuff. Whereas it seemed like 80s, 90s comedy was a lot of hopefully these four people like you, but if they do, you'll have a career forever.
So different, more access, more portals of access.
Yeah, but maybe also more like you have to like keep doing it and keep working on new projects.
That could also make you kind of, like you said, that's the gym workout and keeps you in shape.
I mean, I like that. If you, this is a fun thing to do. And if you get into it and get to do it for work, I think a lot of people like continuing to work hard.
Right. Yeah, it's not working hard. Not an icky thing anymore. Once again, you're listening to Here Now with Rachel C. Rebroadcast is Sunday at noon next week. My guest will be Revolution. Don't miss that. Albert's show is Tuesdays at Bushwick Public House, 8 o'clock. Got it right.
Yeah, yeah. It's called Show My Goodness. You can find it on Instagram and Facebook.
What's some other material that you can share? Like, what are some other things that you've done at this mic?
We've been doing a lot more serious stuff, I guess, for a comedy, but I do have a sillier joke about sci-fi if you want me to do it.
Sure.
It might be a little awkward getting into it in this environment, but I'd love to give it a shot.
Let's not even try to segue then. We're just going to say, I'm going to do this.
All right. I'm going to give you a joke about aliens. Cool. Hey, why is it they always show up naked? Just coming in down here with those long, smooth, gray bodies, so confident, like they're not even supposed to have genitals. It's weird. I like to think it's a goof. You know, like they get here and they're like, hey, dude, if we go down there naked, they'll think we're always naked. They come down here like, here we are. Here's our bodies. And they're like, hey, you guys want to come see our planet? And they get a few people and halfway there, they're like, you got to take off these clothes. You look ridiculous. And like, all right, when in Rome. And then we get there and it's a whole planet full of aliens wearing denim. It's a planet full of goofballs, baby.
It's easier to get them ready for the anal probe if they're already naked. That's
my favorite part about that, though, is that that's not like we haven't publicly met aliens. That's just how every time we've written it, we're like definitely nude.
Yeah. I mean, is it that we would have trouble and an audience would have trouble deciphering like where the alien body ends and the clothing, the fashion begins?
Yeah. Or maybe if it's just since they're human shaped, a big gray head isn't enough to discern.
Yeah.
I've seen guys like that in New York.
No, that's just cosplay. There's just a con in town. There's a con of some.
So that's like something fun I would open up if a crowd seemed hesitant of me. Start gentle, we'll get into it. So
what are some others like social here's a question. Can comedy be it's social commentary, can be a catalyst for social change, do you think?
In odd and unexpected ways. I don't know if you remember this. So Cosby allegations have been a public knowledge forever, but for some reason Hannibal Buress doing a set and mentioning it really sparked a whole wave of people kind of caring finally.
Yeah.
And that was that's unexpected, and it was an odd way for comedy to be a catalyst, but at times it can. And I think there's plenty of comedians making really powerful social commentary and that gathers people to talk about it. And I really like that. But also there's people who are just being silly, and sometimes it's nice to have fun.
Yeah. Sometimes if you can just create a good mood and good experience, that can be a catalyst for social change, especially when there's so much tension and stress in the world. And it's like, it's you're bombarded with it.
You know? I mean, this Louis thing is kind of cool because it shows now that people care. Like the New York Times researched and listened and wrote a real article,
right?
And that people are caring and listening. But also now a lot of female comics are getting a voice from this too, and
and
that kind of spotlight is kind of neat. Marsha Belsky wrote a really cool thing for the New York Times about kind of the lose-lose nature of being a female comic even in today's environment. And I think if you can find it, it's a good read.
It's no one wants to hear this happened with Louis C.K. but people media outlets have, like the Times, gave it credence and treated it like a real story and covered it like in a newsworthy fashion. They, you know, and I remember when Hannibal was just starting out. Yes. So, and so to me, it's also a part of me that's kind of like, and Hannibal is finally famous because he just called out Bill Cosby, which he's been called out before. I mean, he did it in his own so very Hannibal wild. Way.
Yeah.
Hannibal has this very Valium-esque, very, very, always very like this. That's his delivery. And it was kind of like, so it was very Hannibal way of like calling him out, but it was like, you know, and he's not the first comic or anybody who's kind of like got anyone who was frustrated with Bill Cosby, because Bill Cosby was criticizing young people within the African American community for years, and a lot of them were kind of going back with like, really, Bill? just because you don't like, you know, the music I make doesn't mean I'm, you know, and people were kind of, I think people were fed up with him already, and Hannibal just kind of went, you know what, you know why else we're fed up with him? But like how it happened to be Hannibal that broke all that.
Well, that's what's so interesting to me is like there's always comics doing casual sets about why some people are bad, and I don't think they're doing those sets with the intention of here I'm going to burn them down. I'm just doing a set and this is the topic I'm talking about.
Uh-huh.
And it's odd that once in a while people are like, all right, we'll take that one seriously.
Right. And on that note, anything else you want to leave us with?
Albert? That's it. Thank you for having me. Just come check us out every Tuesday at 8, Bushwick Public
House. Check it out.
It's called Show My Goodness. Evan Morrison, Leah Wojciechowski. We've got great lineups.
Please keep me abreast of all the things you are doing. It's wonderful to have you on the program.
It's great to meet you. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for being a part of my humble little stage here. Stay tuned for Frequency Theory with Tom Tenney up next at 8 o'clock. I'm going to close this out with a rough cut of something you won't hear anything else. This is Joe Ferry and the Big Ska Band with Mana Drunk.
I come home Monday night, but drunk as I can be.
So
we see our horse outside the door, where I am and horse should be. So I call my wife, hey woman, kindly tell to me. She sees that horse outside the door, where I am and horse should be. She says, Mana Drunk. Mana drunk, and drunk as he can be. That's a big old piggy that my father gave to me. Now many a day I travel 100 miles or more. But a saddle on a piggy, I might not see that before.
Till it belong, till it, till it belong, till it belong, till it belong time. The people that want me to go deep on me mind.
Man come home Tuesday night, drunk as me can be.
Very
see a coat on the hook, where I man coat should be. So I call my wife, hey woman, kindly tell to me. Who's that coat on the door, where I man coat should be? Say, man a drunk, a man a drunk, him too drunk to see.
So
man come home on Thursday, drunk as
can be.
Selector.
Me see a head on me bed where Iron Man head should be.
Oh, well,
call my wife. Hey,